All right, let's do it. Welcome to another episode of News of the Money World. Today, three topics and 30 minutes, more or less, 10 minutes a topic. We're going to start with New Zealand and then go outward. So the 50-point OCR reduction last week leaves banks and academics divided, I guess, around what comes next. So Reserve Bank of New Zealand might be making a policy error by not going harder and sooner. Time will tell. But maybe they're waiting for instructions from further up line. Then we have China taking action to save their economy, but markets are a little bit unsure how to interpret all of that. And there's mounting fears of Japanification. And then lastly, we'll touch on bond markets, which are telling an interesting story about what might be coming next with inflation and interest rates, vigilantes, front runners of the Fed, or political interference, right? So let's start with last week. Last week was amazing, right? It was like one of the best. It's like Christmas, sort of, or the bit before Christmas.
Christmas comes early for any property owner or mortgage advisor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, finally, there's some optimism to sell out there on the streets rather than just hopium. And that 50-point reduction, it's widely expected by a lot of economists. But yeah, there is a bit of a schism or a chasm, or at least a difference between what some people are thinking should happen. Even I, on a daily basis, I'm kind of flip-flopping all over the show in terms of what I think is coming next, what should happen, and what probably will happen. It's really hard to predict. So what are your general thoughts on this one?
So last week, Reserve Bank dropped 50 basis points, a massive shift versus kind of where they were right back in May. Remember that it was 5 months ago where they were telling us the next move was likely to be higher. And since then, they've dropped the rates by 75 points. I think I'm a wholehearted supporter of dropping these rates. If anything, I kind of think they probably could have gone a little bit harder. From everything that we are seeing in the data in a lot of different areas, the New Zealand economy is on its knees. We've got record liquidations. We've got unemployment climbing. We kind of got GDP going backwards. We've got card spending statistics, which are all falling on a real basis. And so I think it's pretty hard to argue that the economy is not as healthy. Overlay that with the record kind of immigration, so people leaving the country, that those statistics have always got a lag factor. So I go, personally, I think I've been saying this for a little while now, I think the economy is actually in a bit of a worse state than people think. And so therefore, this was the right move. I'm in the camp, and a lot of the economists have already come out pretty firmly saying the next cut in November needs to be another 50 points, and I'm very firmly of that view. I guess one of my big questions is, if we took a jumbo cut of 50 basis points because the economy is struggling, the market is already predicting another 50 points in November, and I think almost no one believes that it's only going to be 25 points in November. The question I kind of have to ask is, why didn't we just do 75 points last week? And why do we? And to me, it raises the question of where does the balance sit between protecting the economy versus inflation? And I'm not convinced we've got that right. But that's also why we're seeing the divergence between the bank economists and the academics, because the academics are firmly voting for let's just kind of stick with the inflation fighting mandate and kind of that's the only thing that matters. Whereas the people operating in the real world, the bankers, are all saying, hold on a sec, our clients are struggling. We need something to change here. We need kind of rapid interest rate.
Kind of see both sides of this one, right? So from an academic point of view, the Reserve Bank of New Zealand should have a mandate to foster price stability, create price stability. They have other mandates, however. And the question is whether they should just be restricted to that one mandate or whether they should continue to operate as if they are basically guardians of the galaxy, right? Like, do they make moves to make sure that there's financial stability? They're the lender of last resort, payment systems oversight, foreign exchange, economic research analysis, macroprudential regulations, LVR restrictions, all those extra stuff, worrying about the environment. There's so many other things that have crept in and they are kind of creeping in. And I guess from a banker's point of view or from anybody's point of view, if you're going to give somebody more power, they're probably going to use it. Whereas I guess from an academic or a purist point of view, what is the function of a central bank? And if they don't have quite a well-defined role, then I guess you have all sorts of political interference that can come in there. And it's really hard to know, well, what is the role of fiscal management versus monetary control? What are your views around whether or not they should just be restricted to that single mandate?
Well, I think I think you've got to come back to first principles. Why are they so focused on that single mandate? It's because there is a view that people are hurt more by inflation than anything else, and particularly people at the bottom end of the socioeconomic group. I guess, personally, I think that I'm not 100% convinced by that argument, because I think that people are probably more impacted by losing their jobs, by family members losing their jobs, by businesses going under, than necessarily by that. I think, and this is part of the problem, right? I don't think you can have one or the other. I think that does need to be a joint mandate, which does remove the accountability. And I also think it's kind of interesting. New Zealand is actually one of the only central banks in the world which has price stability as its core main mandate. So if you think about it, right, the US Fed, they actually only brought price stability in about 2012. So before that, economic stability was the only thing that they really had to focus on, and the stability of the financial system. And so, yeah, I think we are an outlier in kind of the mandate that our central bank has. And I do think that our economy at the moment is potentially paying the price for that. It's, yeah, it is an interesting one, right? I do have to ask the question of, we have, I don't know, I'm guessing 20 or 30 PhDs sitting in our central bank, US Fed, they might have 2,000. Why do we believe we've got better theory than everyone else in the world? And that's the bit that I struggle with a little bit, right? So yeah, that I'm definitely on the fence there, right? I don't think they give up on the mandate on inflation, but I do think an unemployment mandate protecting the economy is equally important, right? Because I do think there are costs to not.
Yeah, but I guess the more things that you bring into the fold of things that are important that we need to deal with, you also need to think about who's been given the job to actually deal with it. Are they even democratically elected? And like you said before, you know, like the Reserve Bank of New Zealand is rather unique in terms of the set of powers that it already has in terms of their influence. Where's the accountability?
But I would say a lot of that stuff has been overreach. So I think you can go, they should have two very clear focuses, or three very clear focuses. Stability of the financial system, which basically means regulating the banks. And I would actually say the broad economic piece, which is kind of what we see in the US and other markets, I think that is too broad. But if they were to go unemployment, that is a single measurable fact, and inflation. And then I think you've got a pretty clear set of guidelines that they can't really stray from. But I do think it kind of gives them that balance that's not one or the other, right? Because at the end of the day, what is their job? Their job is to protect people. And I think if we kind of keep on bringing it back to that piece, then that's where those two things need to work in parallel, right? It shouldn't be jobs or inflation. It needs to be jobs and inflation, and trying to figure out an appropriate balance.
Okay. All right. Well,
would be very strong.
Yeah. And let's keep going with that idea of, I guess, a centralized authority having some degree of influence over our lives. And let's talk about China, right? Where else can you go in the world to see like the pinnacle of power and control and centralization, especially with Xi Jinping at the helm here in China? So a lot of the people, a lot of the advisors, a lot of the experts around him would not necessarily be as free as they would hopefully be here in New Zealand if they saw something going on that they would want to challenge. And as a result, you will likely see the fruits of either a genius at the helm or somebody who's narcissistic. Well, I guess they're all narcissists, aren't they, at that level, surely. Yeah. But let's talk about the China stock market, right? Classic yo-yo symptoms going on. With one week, the stock market has fallen like a stone. The next week, it's pumping over 20%. The markets seem to be a little bit disappointed with the amount of stimulus going on, but they're doing their best to steer themselves away from the ditch. Japanification is a term that I'm trying to learn as much as I can about right now, and it doesn't sound like a very good thing for a whole host of reasons, but that seems to be the term that's being bandied around China and what could be coming next. So what are your general views around whether or not China's stimulus going on is actually going to be enough, and what do you see coming next?
It's a really hard one, right? Because they've been very generous to the property sector, and we kind of know property's caused a lot of their problems in the past. And so that politically, that would have been a big capitulation. Because the point of this has been to kind of break the reliance on the property sector. And so they're almost giving up on that. There's been a lot of support to the stock market. But unfortunately, there hasn't been the direct support to the consumers and to each individual person that had been hoped for. And I think that's really interesting, right? Because it almost shows how far the politics and expectations have come in the last probably wide arguing in the last 5 years, right, where immediately the economy was struggling and all people all around the world going, no, don't worry, the government's just going to step in and save it. So we talk about the don't fight the Fed. We talk about don't fight the government. And actually here was a perfect example of massive expectations that, you know what, the Chinese government was actually just going to follow through with the typical playbook. So coming back to a huge number of the points that you've been talking about over the last couple of years, it's kind of that kind of guiding force and that central intervention into the economy. And unfortunately, as much as all of the kind of the market and capitalistic or the market orientated people love to kind of rail at government intervention, they're now screaming the fact that there's not enough government intervention. So you do have to kind of laugh and believe that there is a little bit, there is a certain irony to all of that. So it's kind of interesting what's happening there at the moment, right? Because I think it demonstrates where investors now, how investors expect governments to play and kind of where they are actually playing. The second point around the Japanification.
It's hard to say. Japanification just rolls off the tongue.
Of the economy, 100%. Basically, you've got population decline. You've got a massively overheated property market. You've also, though, one thing that China's got, which Japan never had, was that strategic tension between the East and the West, which means their export markets. And you saw actually export demand fell, and that number came out overnight for the first time in a long time as well. So it is starting to look increasingly difficult for the Chinese economy, right? Particularly when you put the long-term population trends on top of it, where their Japanese population has been slowly shrinking. But actually, I mean, the Chinese population over the next 50 years, it's meant to halve. I mean, that's not a slow reduction. That's a humongous reduction. Right? And so it is hard to see, because what all of that means is you end up in a world where you go, well, population decline means property prices are likely to keep falling because there's too much property. You've got to build all this infrastructure, which never gets properly used, never gets properly amortized. Kind of all of that drives deflation. Deflation ends up in a world where basically everyone sits there and goes, hold on a sec, I'm not going to spend today because I'm kind of better off saving my dollars because I'm going to be able to buy more and more in the future. And then you end up in a world where people stop spending, which then kind of turns itself into that self-fulfilling prophecy. And look, it's going to be really hard to see how that comes out of here, right? Because no matter how much the Chinese government spends, the only real answer, personally, I think they've got is going to be bailing out the property companies and probably taking the bulldozer to half these projects that haven't yet been completed.
Well, there's one other idea, right? But they also could just do something which is completely unthinkable, and they could actually start appealing to people like you and I, Rupert. Come join us. Come move to our country. Open up the door. Kind of like how the Western countries have used immigration as an offset to this demographic trend. Why don't Japan and China and anyone else who's having this problem open up the floodgates and actually welcome us Westerners in? Do you ever see that happening?
No. Short answer.
Should I force you into giving us a reason why? That would be fun, wouldn't it?
You might not like the reason, and I probably need to, how do I phrase it?
Yeah, we can't.
Culturally, it's just not something that's accepted, right? I mean, I don't know if you guys have looked at, I've been on one of the TV programs at the moment, a program called Pachinko, which kind of shows Koreans, who a big Korean population in Japan that have been there for over kind of since World War II, pre-World War II, and they still haven't been able to integrate into that country. And unfortunately, a lot of the Asian countries are not welcoming to immigration, and it's going to require a massive cultural change for that to happen. So, yeah, that's why I think in the short term it will struggle. But you are right, Darcy, that is the obvious answer. I mean, that's how countries like, I mean, New Zealand and the West are kind of surviving, because otherwise, I mean, the US, New Zealand and Australia would be probably three of the only kind of Western countries with natural population growth. Most others would be negative. Without immigration.
That's right. Yeah, and this ultimately is like the reason why demographics is such a killer, and the reason why in the West we have increasingly problems with immigration. We want to, but there are side effects with that as well, is actually you trace it all back down to the financial system itself. And you trace that all back to this desire of centralized authorities in controlling it. Where does that desire come from? Well, it comes from the people who allow them to or put them in charge because people want a higher authority to govern them. And I guess if I was thinking about Japanification just from a New Zealand context, thinking, hey, well, this sounds like a horrible virus, right? It's like herpes or something like that. Maybe we can get some special medicine for killing that thing before it spreads, right? But let's say Japanification spreads to China. Let's say it spreads to the rest of the world. Well, what would it mean to New Zealand, right? And some of the symptoms and signs of Japanification might include, I don't know, runny noses, shortness of breath, but also deflation. Hey, deflation sounds pretty cool though, because that means things get cheaper. But the flip side of that is that people delay consumption and that causes long-term problems as well. And then, well, hey, house prices get cheaper, but they actually risk crashing. And then that is effectively the base layer of the financial system here in New Zealand. That's no good either. So there's all these like things like downstream problems that happen as a result. And it's like anything, you change one variable and you upset the whole freaking thing, right? Like everything becomes unstable and there's no magic bullet, is there?
There is no magic bullet. I mean, arguably New Zealand would actually be far better off in a Japanification world than Japan or China, because to be fair, we haven't built the infrastructure for the last 1.5 million people that have come here. So we're actually, to a certain extent, we might actually be slightly better off for it. The problem with countries like Japan and China is they've built the infrastructure, right? So they've gone and they built it early. They kind of used a huge amount of, so coming out, it was when the Japanese economy was building, they built the infrastructure and the housing for a big country. Japan have done that over the last kind of 10, 15 years through multiple stimulus. So actually, there's a strong argument that New Zealand would be far better off with Japanification than either of those two countries where it's currently headed.
Interesting, eh? Interesting. Okay, well, let's move on. You
described it really well. Deflation is a nice panacea that lots of people want until they understand what it truly means. And the house pricing one is a massive one, right? Because it's not just once you move into house price deflation, then you end up with a banking crisis. Look what happened. That was basically the GFC. It was all about a banking crisis, right? Effectively, house prices, mortgages went bust, and it turned into a pretty ugly cycle pretty quickly. Asian debt crisis, that was again started off as a Japanese property crisis. So yeah, it's definitely not a world that you want to be
in. No. And I guess there's different types of deflation as well. Like there's deflation that's the outcome of negative economic activity. There's deflation because that's just the natural order of things when technology moves in and makes everything cheaper. And even with interest rates, right? Like there's central banks that will reduce the interest rate to stimulate economic activity, but low interest rates can also be seen as a symptom of deflation itself as well. Like the tail can wag the dog and it can also go the other way around. And so when you look at things like the bond market or gold prices, which I've been doing lately, which is thoroughly satisfying, by the way, Rupert, for other reasons that we can discuss later, it kind of says something is going on, which is different from what the kind of main narrative is with falling interest rates, which is, hey, we've won the battle on inflation. Now we can lower the interest rates to take the foot off the neck of the economy because we've stamped out inflation, or at the very least, things are going in the right direction. And that is a very, very, that's a nice message to believe, especially with where we've been. However, when we look at the bond market, it might be telling us a little bit of a different story with inflation, right? And so can you break it down? We've had the 10-year yields grow. We've had the 5-year yields grow. So that means that bond prices are going down if yields are going up. What is it saying about what the market thinks about inflation?
Well, it's an interesting one, right? I think I'll just pull out my numbers, but the 5-year yield is up kind of 50 basis points. The 10-year yield is up another 50 basis points over the last kind of 3 or 4 weeks. And we're actually now back to having these interest rates back to pre-GFC levels. Even in New Zealand, where we're kind of accelerating our interest rate cutting path, the 5-year kind of yield's done exactly the same thing. So it's up 30, 40 basis points. So what does it mean? Fundamentally, it means that the interest rate markets are saying we are never going to return back to that post-GFC world. We're not going to get back to a world of interest rates and mortgage rates down into that kind of 3 to 5%. It's almost, and it's kind of saying, hey, we do think inflation is going to need to be a little bit higher. We do think interest rates are going to kind of revert back to their longer term norms, which is kind of probably in that 4 to 5% versus being in that 2 to 4% range to fight that higher inflation. It is really interesting. And I think it's particularly for a lot of people who are currently sitting there going, you know what, short-term mortgages, yeah, I'm not going to take my 5.5% mortgage right now because it's about to drop and I'll just wait till I get it back to 3.5%. I think the interest rate market is very clearly saying we are going back to the old normal versus the recent normal. Inflation is expected to kind of stick around into that kind of 2 to 3% mark. Central banks are no longer going to need ultra low interest rate to keep that inflation rate down. Yeah. And I've been doing quite a lot of thinking about this, which is unusual for me to think. One of the big things is the last 25 years has been an amazing time, right? And I'm not sure if we've had this conversation before, but you go, we had the internet, and that boom happened kind of late 90s, but the true productivity gains of that happened in the early 2000s. We had outsourcing manufacturing to China and to kind of the Southeast Asia over that period as well. So for the last 25 years, we've had these amazing things that have driven productivity through the economy and actually reduced costs the whole way through. So that's why central banks have had to fight so hard to kind of get inflation. Looking forward over the next 25 years, what do we see happening, right? Are we going to move production from Asia into Africa? Is that kind of where we're going to go? Because that's probably the only part of the world left with very true low-cost kind of economies. Does AI do the same as our economy that we've had, that the internet did? I struggle to see that as well. And so, yeah, I kind of go that period of kind of the 1990s or even kind of the 1960s, is that actually what we should be looking at as the normal for what period that we're looking into, which means normalish inflation in that kind of 2 to 3% range, interest rates kind of an OCR probably hovering in that kind of 4 to 4.5% or hovering between 4 to 5%. I mean, that's kind of what, in my mind, the interest rate market is telling us right now.
So that's kind of a soft landing, or that's kind of sounds like a reasonably soft landing to me, because we're not very far away from the ground then.
It's a very soft landing. There is no real landing, right? And I think it's also indicative of, well, coming back to the point I made on China, it's coming back to that point around where investors currently see what the role of government in a lot of this stuff, where they're basically going to turn around and go, you know what, we're just going to pay it out and we're going to do everything we can to protect the economy. And actually, that's what we saw a couple of weeks ago or a month ago with the US Fed, where effectively what they did is they said, you know what, inflation's probably still a little bit high, but we're petrified about the economy, so we're going to put through 50 basis point cut. If there was ever a sign of where their priorities lie, that was it.
Yeah.
And that's why the bond market reacted the way they have, right? Coming back to the old story, don't fight the Fed. And the Fed is saying, we are not going to let a recession happen. So therefore, you guys, you can lock in your soft landing. And the bond market has reacted.
Mm. So just to pull on that thread that you were putting out there around post-internet, I guess, the productivity gains seen from the explosion of the internet. I agree that it's kind of hard to see this, but in terms of the benefit that we had as one of the Western economies or Western aligned economies of globalism, that benefit where effectively we were tapping into cheaper labor so that the cost of our goods became cheaper. I think we're going to see globalism in a sense, and maybe I'm reaching too far into the future because that's definitely a possibility, but I'm also cognizant of the fact that technology is exponential. And so at some stage, you're going to get whiplash anyway. If I was to think about this, it kind of feels like AI, like I was watching that launch of robotics that Tesla put on last week. So I was watching these robots, right? And phenomenal what they can do. Maybe if there was some person behind a green curtain controlling them, either way, I understand enough about AI to know what is technically possible. And I understand a little bit about robotics, understand what's possible there to suggest that, hey, maybe is there a possibility here that given enough time, and assuming the cost of electricity approaches zero over the long run, which I would agree is quite likely, don't we have some sort of a proxy here in terms of a new type of globalism in the form of AI and robotics? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good point. AI and robotics can potentially be absolute game changer. The second point you raised is, I think, probably more real and more important as well, where kind of the solar boom and renewable energy and what that does to energy prices. Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of things that could be there, right? I guess there's a flip side to that, and it's a little bit of kind of like what we're seeing right now in the US. Both of those two things will require a material rewiring of economies. So if you think, put those two things through, right, where you go, the current election has been being fought in the Rust Belt in the US, and particularly you go, robotics and automation means a hell of a lot more jobs go. The only difference is that you can't blame China anymore. You're blaming technology. And then you're also getting rid of the energy sector. At the moment that you've kind of get rid of the energy sector. And so on one hand, you are 100% right that those two things have potential to completely transform economies and move us back into that deflationary world. But the flip side is, at what political cost? And then what does that do? Plus also we have a world where we're actually moving into deglobalization. Yeah, I am fascinated to see where that goes. I think those two shifts where you're basically saying all manufacturing has become automated and no longer needs people, which I agree we shouldn't be too far away from that. That's what does that do to kind of society, right? Where lowering jobs are gone.
It's a mess. But welcome to creative destruction. The reason why that destruction word is put on the end of it is that whenever there's like a new advancement, there's always side effects which create a lot of uncertainty and, dare I say, even instability, which kind of explains where we're at in the world right now. Yeah. Man, we've covered a ton of ground as usual. Three topics, 10 minutes, almost nailed it, I'd say. Rupert, well done. We didn't even really get onto some of the other spillover conversations that could be spawned off of this, but perhaps we can watch this episode before we have our next conversation to pick it up next week. How's that sound?
Perfect. Yeah, there's definitely a whole lot happening right now. It'll be fascinating. And then the other point that's going to be fascinating to see next week is the betting markets have switched, right? And so Trump is kind of now in a world of winning, and we see the stock market go for it, which is actually it's really interesting, but more on that next week.
Yeah. Oh. And hey, should we talk about geopolitics as well next week? Because there's stuff going down there too. So, whew. All right. Yeah. Have a good one though, Rupert. And thanks for the chat today.
Thanks, Darcy.